The Three-Minute Medium. Robert Sandel reviews three decades of the pop music business and the business of making pop music.
There is a house in New Orleans.
The band were on tour around the country. They were in Liverpool one night. They came down on the overnight train. Mickey picked them up at 6:30 in the morning at the station, took them to the studio. They were set up at 7:45, right? At 8:00, the session was starting. It was the beginning of the session. They'd recorded House of the Rising Sun, finished by 8:15, right? So they still had 2¾ hours left on the session. So they did the rest of the album, got the 1:00 train back up to Liverpool to carry on their tour. You know, I mean, that's very quick. But you know, you listen to House of the Rising Sun then and you go, wow, that record.
For instance, if we looked at our last single, So Hard, in House of My Studio Unit, we spent probably 4 days on it. In some West London, we spent a further 2 days on it. And so we then give it to Julian Mendelsohn, who we often work with. He worked with us on Liza Minnelli's album and most of our own albums. And he mixes it. Now, when you say mixes it, he's now got 48 tracks of material. He then spends 2 days mixing it. So I suppose overall, by our standards, it's not bad. It's taken 7 or 8 days to do.
A tale of two British hit singles, one made in 1964, one in 1990. 26 years in which the making of 3-minute pop records has evolved into a high-rolling game of multiplying numbers. In the studio, the technology and timescales of the recording process have mushroomed. In the high street, our appetite for the product grows larger every year. In 1963, we spent around £25 million on pop records. In 1990, retail sales will top £750 million. It's a remarkable story, but one which is usually told back to front. Pop music's a branch of show business in which we regularly hear lots about the show and very little about the business. Yet it's the people off the record who write the checks and push the buttons who've had as much influence on the way the music sounds as the musicians themselves. Producer Glyn Johns was there at the beginning.
In those days, one went to work in a collar and tie. You couldn't turn up without a jacket on, you know. The maintenance guys all wore white coats. It was really quite extraordinary, like going to Sainsbury's. The older chaps didn't really understand this new music at all. It was just totally beyond them. They were used to recording acoustic music, and they developed a technique to do that. And then all of a sudden, these young chaps started turning up with loud guitars and playing the drums much more loudly and viciously than anybody else had before. They didn't really understand. They hated the music. They thought it was a noise. They didn't understand it. And so those sessions were given to us kids who were just starting, really, who couldn't get enough of it. We loved it. And between us, we sort of developed a technique to record.
Recording electric instruments was a problem. The old-fashioned method of using a single microphone suspended above the group rather like a light bulb was fine for orchestras, but it didn't really suit The Who, The Kinks, The Small Faces or The Rolling Stones. So with them, Glyn Johns started using a whole battery of microphones and acoustic screens, a process which has been developed into a layering technique, the multi-track recording of today.
Okay, testing. This is Steve Lillywhite, and I'm just about to explain The Neville Brothers in the Still of the Night. So I'm going to... I'll give you a little bit more volume here. So we've got the drums, just the drums in there. And we'll bring in some congas. And... hang on, the next thing up. Bass player. And... let's put these up. Okay, we've got the bass, drums, and percussion in there. We'll put a bit of guitar in. Here's a bit of guitar. And we have the guitar, and now a bit of piano, I think. and the wonderful Aaron Neville.
This may sound like a smooth and well-ordered process now, but back at the dawn of multi-track recording in the 60s, studio engineers like Glyn Johns were regarded more as magicians than technicians.
They'd come up with all the sounds they could get out of their guitars and their amps and changed all that, and they weren't satisfied. Now they wanted something else, and nobody was manufacturing equipment that they could use, that they could plug into to come up with new sounds. So they come into the studio and aim at us and say, well, right, what can we do different? How can we get my... I don't want my guitar to sound like a guitar. I want it to sound like something else. Or I don't want the snare drum to sound like a snare drum or whatever. And so one was constantly scratching your head. I remember one occasion, Jagger actually taking me out for a cup of tea and sitting me down in the cafe across the road from Olympic Studios and giving me this whole chat and saying, you've got to come up with some new sounds for us.
The arrival of these new sounds attracted a new kind of entrepreneur. Peter Jenner, manager, producer, now owner of a record label, was a lecturer at the LSE in 1965.
It wasn't really until sort of things like the Beatles started doing their sort of rubber soul and stuff like that, and Bob Dylan and all that stuff, that one began to see that pop music was interesting stuff. I mean, I think it's classic classism, really. It was only when the sort of white middle classes started making pop records that one started taking it seriously, I think, as long as it was those working class people with those nasty street traders managing them. You know, one couldn't take those sort of people seriously, my dear. You know, I mean, I'm classic sort of, you know, middle class background. I found it very hard to relate to Elvis Presley. You know, I couldn't hear the lyrics. What was he going on about? I mean, I did suffer from that.
Jenner's suffering ended one night when he discovered four young men who, under his guidance, helped to change the way pop music was made and marketed. They called themselves Pink Floyd.
Trying to mark some exam papers and getting very bored, and they were doing a gig which some friends of friends were putting on, and I went along to see it at the Marquee, and there they were, and I was intrigued. You know, I couldn't work out where the noise was coming from. I remember walking around the stage looking to try and work out where the noise was coming from, and that was what got me interested. And the Floyd were the first band that EMI signed with a commitment to do an album from the word go. I mean, at that point, you would do a singles deal, and if it went terrifically well, you'd bash out a few more songs and put it out as an album, you know. And, I mean, at that time, probably, there were only probably four or five English, you know, rock bands who'd had albums, I mean, seriously at all. I mean, the sort of the Shadows and Cliff and the Shadows, but albums were pretty rare things back then.
The emergence of the long player as the prime carrier of pop music happened quite suddenly in 1967. Sonic experimentation demanded more space than the old 7-inch single format allowed. And while Peter Jenner's Pink Floyd were making their debut album at EMI's Abbey Road Studios, the Beatles were down the corridor making another of theirs. This one, though, was different.
Sgt. Pepper was so revolutionary, it was ridiculous. No one had ever heard anything like that. They just took the whole process and turned it on its head. Just by going, well, sorry, take your white coat off and your tie and just start thinking, you know, forget about the rule book, throw that out the window. Don't apply all the rules that you've been told, or the meter must never go in the red, or you can't ever patch this into there, or whatever else. Throw all that out and see what happens. What would happen if you took that piece of equipment and plugged it into that? And then, we've got plenty of time, let's just try. And they jiggle and fiddle until they came up with stuff. And that made us all think, oh, well, yeah. I mean, I've been breaking the rules for years anyway, but that was more out of incompetence than anything else.
Thank you.
Well, that whole period, that whole psychedelic period, was a sense of sort of artiness was coming into pop music. It wasn't all about just having hits. It was all about art and creativity and things like that. And once you let nasty things like art and creativity get into it, you really have, you know, opened Pandora's box in a big way.
The Beatles spent an unprecedented 4 months recording Sgt. Pepper's. Among other things, its success meant that loitering in recording studios became all the rage. The Rolling Stones' next album, Their Satanic Majesty's Request, caused sleepless nights for Glyn Johns.
One track we did, they came in with a box of percussion instruments, and they each took one and just played percussion for 14 minutes onto a piece of tape. Everybody hitting something different. I haven't got a clue what they were about. I mean, they were just trying something. I don't know. God knows. No one bothered to tell me. They just carried on doing it. And they come in and they sit and play back this 14 minutes of bonkity bingity, whatever it was. Go, oh, no, no, no. I think we'd better throw another one. I mean, and they go and do another. It's done exactly this. Just a load of rubbish. All night. Oh, no, no. I think we can do a better one than that. And I'd have to sit there and put up with it. Really. Anyway, it sold. It made them money. I don't know.
By the time that Satanic Majesties appeared, everybody was making more money than ever before. The album, a quirky artistic initiative to begin with, rapidly became a bestseller. Sales of LPs in Britain, which had only just been inching up previously, suddenly jumped by 30% in 1967. The record companies could hardly believe their luck.
Album sales did for their accounts what CD sales did for their accounts in the 80s, and money went through the roof. You know, when people started running out and buying Beatles albums by the hundreds of thousands and by the millions, this was really good news for the record companies. I mean, the growth in the music industry, especially obviously for English music, because suddenly there was English music which had been as interesting to the rest of the world as Luxembourg music is to us. You know, I mean, no one was interested in an English record, pop music record, in 1963 or 62 before the Beatles. You know, I mean, the scale of that change is very important to understand. So I think the English record companies were delighted. They'd never seen so much money coming through, and if that meant they had to indulge, I mean, they'd never seen so much money, and they didn't know where or why it was happening. So they were very confused about it. So they all started their underground labels and their avant-garde labels, and they would sign anything which came in the door with long hair or had done two gigs at the speakeasy.
Neil Tennant of disco supergroup Pet Shop Boys feels it was precisely the indulging of these wayward and grandiose practices which led 10 years on to a violent counter-reaction.
I think a lot of those tendencies were actually corrected by punk. I think the thing that punk did, which everyone almost goes unnoticed, is that in rock music, it made all the songs short. If you were to do a survey of rock LPs before 1977, the average length of the track was probably 6 or 7 minutes. After punk, no matter who you were, I think if you look at the Rolling Stones album, Some Girls, the classic response, the Rolling Stones are always fabulously opportunist, I think, and it was suddenly full of 3 minutes. Almost punky pop songs, and that I think those tendencies that you're talking about were corrected by punk.
Arty concepts, elaborate recording techniques, huge record sales had created a generation of 70s pop stars too remote to impress younger performers. The big idea of the punk ethos was alienation, and it was often expressed not just in general terms of alienation from society, but more precisely alienation from the record industry itself. Joe Strummer, leader of seminal punk band The Clash.
I never felt I was doing anything that was anything to do with the music industry, because it got very bloated. They were standing on Persian carpets to play their 20-minute pieces, and they had three articulated lorries with all their equipment, and so on and so on. I never thought that we could make a record, and then punk came along, and I felt that I'd cheated myself, that my attitudes had been formed by, say, the trade papers or some inferiority complex. And when I realised that what we had to say was just as viable as what any of these huge superstars had to say.
So punk was in part a technical argument about how you said things. It was an attempt to take pop music out of the hands of the technocrats and restore some of the simplicity and directness of a song like The House of the Rising Sun. The Beatles never did and never could have performed Sgt. Pepper's live. Punk was all about playing in public.
We had a terrible experience in a German studio, like White Riot, okay, Now, remember, White Riot has a very fast clip to it, a beat, you know, very fast, okay? We went to this German studio, first TV studio, and they stood us on the stage and they went, right, to playback! And like, on a tinny speaker 100 yards in the air, at the other end of the aircraft hangar, I could hear a drum roll. And I stood there going, what is this, you know? And the Germans went, throw them out! Immediately after the first rehearsal, and we were thrown out of the TV studios. And then when we came back to England, they said, do you want to go on Top of the Pops? And I said, what? Same like that. And they went, well, perhaps you could have it a bit louder while you mime to it. And to me, the idea of this terribly physical tune, to mime to White Riot, I mean, the whole thing, not only is it physically impossible, but spiritually ridiculous. And so I just said, never mind.
There was one other important way in which punk profoundly altered the relationship between the pop industry and its artists. In the 60s, Brian Epstein spent months commuting to London to secure a contract for the Beatles. With the suddenness and the immediate impact of punk, it was the record companies and people like David Bates, head of artists and repertoire at Phonogram Records, who had to do the chasing.
Everything became a lot more instant. Bands were forming overnight, playing six gigs, and people had to have a punk band on the roster, or people had to have that particular band on the roster. And so that overnight effect escalated in the mid to late 70s. When that was happening, a lot of young people were brought into the industry and then sent scurrying around the country. The importance of the music press, the national music press, rose to enormous heights at that time, whereby they would put somebody on the front cover and instantly 10 A&R men would rush off to go and try and find that band. Now, much to the cost, I imagine, of both the record companies and the music papers.
More than 10 years later, the legacy of this frantic pursuit of fresh talent has started to warp the career development of young artists. The Beatles played hundreds of gigs before they were signed to EMI Records in 1962. Nowadays, though, lengthy apprenticeships on the live circuit have been sharply truncated. David Bates recently tried to sign a young Irish group called An Emotional Fish for Polygram, but he wasn't the only one.
Here's a great example of a band who I saw on their 10th ever gig. In a matter of weeks, a bidding war had erupted, and people such as Ahmet Ertegun, who is a very famous gentleman who owns or did own Atlantic Records, who was a producer of the 40s and 50s, was flown over, and other famous industryites were flown into Dublin, and they were all set against each other. And overnight, this poor little band that had only done 10, 12 gigs had the world at its feet. Their album came out and people were disappointed. Industry people sort of scoffed. And that's a shame. It's a shame because they are very good. They weren't given time to develop. And the album isn't that bad. And they are going to be, if they can get through this, I feel still a good band. But the pressure that must have been forced on them, the record company, the manager and everybody else involved must have been incredible.
This doesn't sound like a very efficient R&D program. The record companies have effectively forced themselves into a cul-de-sac, and they know it. David Bates's boss at Polygram Records, Maurice Oberstein, is surprisingly quick to acknowledge the scale of the problem.
I think you've come upon what is the real problem that competition may have forced out of the greenhouse the artists too quickly who are not ready for developing their careers and have been blighted by the first frost. Competition has gotten us to record the artists and get their records out perhaps too soon. And not perhaps too soon for the records that are made, but perhaps too soon for the artists then to know how to work their career properly. That they then go on stage, they then go on Top of the Pops, they then go to be interviewed by the press, and they have no training, no background. They haven't been to RADA. They haven't had a chance to develop from some kind of repertory sense, as artists perhaps did in the past when they could be allowed, or were forced to, work clubs.
One of the most interesting examples in recent years of an artist who survived in spite of the misguided eagerness of the modern promotional process is Chris Rea. Rea's most recent album, The Road to Hell, has been one of the biggest selling albums of 1990 in the UK. The wonder is that he ever got to make it at all. Rea achieved his first success in 1978. Since then, his career has revolved around the struggle with corporate know-alls.
I was a classic example of a brand new artist. People loved his songs, people loved his voice. There started to become a little bit of a rush on who should sign him. And the record company obviously didn't want to listen to me because I'd been living in Middlesbrough. And what did I know about the business? So they didn't want to talk to me about it at all. So they amongst themselves decided that I should have a world-class producer. At that point in time, there didn't come any bigger really than Elton John's producer. But the record company liked that. That all clicked in nicely with their ideas of, if Chris turns out to be the next Elton John, that'll do us fine. You know, all the time they're looking at Elton John's sales figures and thinking, yeah, Chris Rea will be the next Elton John. And I actually don't know what is the way of working. I've never done it before. I presume this is what happens to everybody. So the best session men in England are hired. And I wave goodbye to the guys I've always worked with in Middlesbrough. I'm told I can't work with them. I wasn't on a very good recording contract. My advance, I think, was £18 a week, which is outrageous. The percentage I was on almost made it impossible for me to pay back the cost of the record, even if the record was platinum. The album goes on for quite a long time while discussions are had between producers, managers and record companies. Nice expensive dinners and all the time I laugh now at how hilariously naive I was as a new artist. I mean, if something like that started to happen now, the £28 sledgehammer would just come crashing down. This ain't no technological breakdown. Oh no, this is the road to hell.
Well, it may not have been quite the road to hell, but the story of the last decade of pop music has certainly been one of unfulfilled promise. The superstars of the 60s and 70s are all too often the superstars of the 90s as well. Hardly anyone of internationally superstellar proportions emerged during the 1980s. Take out Madonna, Prince and George Michael, and who are you left with? The casualty rate among apparently talented newcomers has been appalling. Culture Club, Frankie Goes to Hollywood, Nick Kershaw, Curiosity Killed the Cat, Paul Young, Terence Trent D'Arby have all been eclipsed. For the survivors, it's a chilling thought.
It's like a cold wind that gets inside your overcoat. And you feel it and you shudder because you actually realise, if you're not stupid and you're not dumb, you realise that that could have been you. It's like racing drivers who don't like talking about people who get injured. You feel it and you know it and you try to move on to a different subject because you know that that could have happened to you. And in fact, it can always happen to you anyway.
One of the reasons why new stars have been fading so fast over the past decade can be put down to the changing economic climate between 1979 and 1982. Just as Sgt. Pepper's inaugurated a period of massive expansion in the record industry, so punk was the harbinger of recession. For the first and only time since the war, we were buying fewer records, and the commercial pressures intensified on artists signed to companies like the world's biggest record company, Polygram.
Bad times, bad sales, recession, loss of jobs, loss of opportunity probably was the greatest thing in that you then had to restrict your recording efforts to those that were those that had a much greater chance for success and limit the number of new artists that you could record that were speculative.
Before the 1980s, the marketing of albums was a comparatively unrefined process. In the commercially cautious climate which followed the 79 to 82 recession, the creation and milking of blockbuster albums became a primary objective. The biggest selling record ever in the history of recorded music was Michael Jackson's Thriller. Released in 1982, it's now sold nearly 50 million copies worldwide. Peter Jenner.
You make a lot more money selling an extra million Michael Jackson records than you do on breaking a new act and selling a million records from scratch, because for that you've got to make the record, you've got to do the promotion, you've got to do all that and all the energy and all the effort. Whereas just another million Michael Jackson records is just, all you'll do is have the machines working for a little bit longer. Just go chonk, 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 chonk. Every time the machine goes chonk, that's another tenner. Chonk, 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 chonk. Out goes the money, you see. So what they want to do is to get those records, which, and this is a very sensible economic decision in some ways, that will sell the X million copies. So once you're going after that, then you're going to buy the band that you think can make those X million copies.
So the problem becomes not the creative one of developing talent, but the hard-nosed commercial one of protecting your investment. After you've won the bidding war and signed what you hope will be your blockbuster band, what then?
Everyone then at that point is trying to maximise the chance of coming through economically, right? So you hire the important producer, the successful producer. He hires the best studios and the best engineers. Everyone's going for top money as well, because they know they're the best or they're the hottest at that moment. So the money is now, at this point, is really beginning to roll, you know. But once you've started, then you're in, you know. Okay, there you are, the A&R man. You've now just spent £1 million. In comes the tapes. Oh, it just sounds like a record. Oh, blimey. Oh, it doesn't sound like an instant, you know, this doesn't sound like the most important record that's ever made. It just sounds like another record, because we're all just human. It is just another record. So this is very hard for the, you know, to get to terms with. So at this point, you better think, we'd better go to so-and-so for a remix in New York. So whoosh, off it goes to New York for a remix. You know, and everybody gets on planes and leaps off of first class and whatever and gets, you know, remixes go on. Then we need those also for marketing. We've got to have another different sort of remix because we'll need the 12-inch because we've got to get the single in the charts. If we don't get the single in the charts, we're not going to get the sell enough album. So we've got to get three singles in the charts. We've got to have three singles. We need 12 inches for each of those singles, and we need dance mixes, and we better have something. It just goes on and on and on, the marketing, because we're all now at this point, we're geared up. We've now spent X million pounds. We're hoping to sell X million copies. At this point, nothing, you know, there's too much is invested. You just go on spending the money until you really think, well, there's nothing I can do.
At this point, the artists themselves have been virtually written out of the script.
I've actually been ashamed of some of the things that have eventually come out, you know, because when the record's finished, say 8 years ago, my head would be on absolutely backwards. I'd completely forgotten the inspiration and reasons why I was starting to do that album. And there'd been so much remixes, mixes, expense, financial pressure, that in the end, it ended, and I couldn't listen to that record anymore. I heard every edit, every remix. I could even hear people breathing on the record. It was that close to you. And then there's a pause, and then the record comes out 3 months later. And suddenly your head's on straight again, and you listen to it, and you think, oh, my God, that's absolutely terrible. And it just makes you go all weak, and you want to cry, you know. You just want to beat your head to death on a block or something.
And so, quite often, do the people who authorise all that spending, people like David Bates from PolyGram.
Certainly, there's a band that I was involved with, a band called Vitamin Z, which is a band that took a long time to make their album, on their first album, and by the time we'd finished, I guess, after two albums, which is actually, we'd scrapped another one, it became sort of two-stroke-three albums, we were £600,000 in debt. And there's a band that most people would have never have heard of.
A lot of this money actually gets spent in the recording studio itself. The proliferation of electronic options has turned recording into a self-conscious pursuit of sonic perfection, a pointless navel-gazing exercise in the opinion of one of punk's most eloquent alumni, Joe Strummer.
At the time, I don't think there was too much of this, like, let's just record the bass drum on its own and let's listen to every beat. I think the 256th beat, it's a little mellow.
Right.
Let's get out the computers and let's analyse the spectrum of that 269th beat. I mean, this actually goes on. I should imagine if I was a fly in Quincy Jones's studio, I should imagine this would be going on, like, put that beat up onto a television screen and look at its waveform, and then they'd recreate that on another battery of computers. And to me, I'd rather use my ear, you know, like, yes, turn it up, that sounds good.
Paradoxically, though, the availability and relative inexpensiveness of some of this new technology has made it easier now for young musicians who can't afford Quincy Jones's studio rates to make quality recordings at home. Anne Dudley is a member of 1980s techno group Art of Noise.
15 years ago, it was only superstar rock musicians who had studios in their own homes. The studio technology was incredibly expensive. In the last few years, it's become much cheaper. Almost every musician has some kind of home recording studio in which they can try out ideas. The Porter Studio, which was like a four-track cassette, came out in, I think, the early 1980s. And people suddenly began to realise how music was constructed in studios and began to learn about it.
So while David Bates was spending hundreds of thousands of pounds on an expensive failure like Vitamin Z, cut-price technology was bringing the production of hit singles much closer to home.
Tank fly, boss walk, jam, nitty-gritty, you're listening to the boy from the big bad city. This is Jam Hot. This is Jam Hot.
The biggest single of 1989 was Beats International, Dudley Bismick. That cost £400 to make in someone's bedroom. So it is very possible now with the technology available. I would think that big recording studios are going to have a lot of trouble making ends meet. You know, the top of the line, between £1,000 and £1,500 a day studios. A lot are going to go out of business because there are a lot of them.
Another development which might be assisting the slide of studios towards bankruptcy is the huge growth in sales of what are known as catalogue items. These are old albums re-released often for the first time on compact disc, and sometimes without any attempt to enhance the quality of the original master tapes, which were made, of course, for vinyl, by producers like Glyn Johns, who aren't at all happy now about the way they sound on CD.
Well, I haven't heard one yet that's been done justice. Do you know what? What really annoys me is there hasn't been one record company yet that's contacted me and said, we're going to release on CD, would you care to remaster it for us? Not one. Which I find quite extraordinary. Why they wouldn't do that, I don't know. But they obviously aren't that concerned, or alternatively they think perhaps that what I did when I mastered the record in the first place really didn't matter, which is of course complete nonsense. As it happens, I don't actually do very much when I master. I try and get what I want on the tape, and my main concern when I master a record is to just get what's on the tape on the record. And unfortunately, the process very often doesn't allow that if you're not careful, and it actually, you can ruin a record in the mastering phase quite easily without actually doing anything to it.
But the fact remains that nearly one in four of the albums we now buy is some form of repackaged oldie. Further proof, perhaps, of the power of marketing. Neil Tennant.
Something I think which has gone unnoticed, that the lead which marketing has taken, or took in the 1980s, the lead was taken by what one might call the dinosaur act. So, for instance, if one looks at the LP charts of the moment, you'll see that Phil Collins has got the triple live set, which is a pure marketing exercise. You know, it's not his greatest hits, but it is the greatest hits played live for Christmas.
Four of the top five albums in the pre-Christmas album chart were essentially greatest hits compilations featuring Madonna, Phil Collins, Elton John and Cliff Richard. According to its critics, the pop industry is now living dangerously off the back of past glories. Not so, says Morris Oberstein.
The question of packaging, releasing compilation albums of greatest hits is no different than the collected works of Thackeray or of Dickens. The fact that the collected works of Elton John or the collected works of other interesting artists is just the nature of putting bits and pieces together in an anthology. For us, it's also a way of earning money in order to stay in business, to invest in talent. So it's not the horse and cart in this is very simply, if we make money, we have money to invest in new talent. If we don't make money, we don't have money to invest in new talent.
So back to the interesting question of investment in new talent. There's no doubt that it costs far more to launch a new act today than it did when the Animals made the House of the Rising Sun in the early 60s, and a large proportion of this cost gets absorbed in an exciting new promotional gambit, the pop video.
Videos have become a kind of bore for everyone in the music industry. It's a simple fact, which I don't think maybe the public realise, that it costs so much bloody money. An album to make nowadays probably costs in the region of between £150,000 and £300,000. If you make really four singles of the album, that means four videos, you're probably going to spend a further £200,000 or £300,000 making those four videos. And the music business, of course, sneakily charges most of this back to the artist.
I can quote you a case of an artist that I work with who is quite brilliant, and a rare exception today, she got signed by a record label against the odds. She's really fine talent, great depth of talent, made an album. They made three videos that cost more than it cost me to make the record. We made another album. They made three more videos that cost more than the second album cost. And as a result, she was so much in the hole, in debt to the record company, at the end of the second album, they had to drop her.
In many ways, the pop music industry of 1990 sounds like a far less efficient conduit for creative musical talent than the seemingly more haphazard business which existed in the 1960s. But despite the spiralling costs of promotion and recording, the wastefulness of the bidding wars, and the blighting of careers through insensitive marketing, one of Britain's healthiest industries is the record business.
British music in the United States, for example, represents 25% of the music sold in America. We bring those invisible earnings back to Britain. Britain, you know, the record industry is a far more significant earner than anyone gives it credit for being, because of these foreign earnings that we build up. To be 25% of a market, as we are in America, is the most successful industry that Britain has on a worldwide basis, the music industry.
When you think of bands like Def Leppard, who sell close to 11 million albums in America alone, plus, you know, the odd million they sell in Canada and a few million they sell around the rest of the world. Dire Straits, who can go off and sell 18, 20 million albums. What is that worth? Probably close to £200 million. So if it was an industry that did that, a particular company that did that, I'm sure that they would get the Queen's Award to the industry and people would go, aren't they brilliant? But people don't tend to think that bands can do that, and we can bring that kind of income into this country.
Perhaps it's a hydra-headed monster in that, okay, if your son says, Dad, can I have a synthesizer? I'm going to be a pop star. Nowadays you'd say, jolly good, son, here, go up in the bedroom, practice. But in the old days you'd have gone, a guitar, no, you know. But perhaps it just breaks off and there'll be a kind of respectable, I imagine there'll be a respectable area of rock where the sons of the middle class can go in and be journeymen, sort of a Phil Collins-inspired phalanx. And yet there'll be other areas, say, acid house, where if your son said, Dad, I'm going to get one of those light shows and really freak out, then you could go, no. So there's always areas where rock and roll still is rock and roll, in that your parents must hate it.
The 3-Minute Medium was presented by Robert Sandel. The producer was Chris Paley.